are two cases on the docket this morning, but before we get started, on behalf of the court, I want to recognize that on all sides there has been a great deal of pro bono or near pro bono work that has been done, and for the court, we are grateful to you for the efforts that have gone into this case, these two cases. We begin with the case of Canales, and again, I'm grateful. I understand that there's been agreement reached among the parties as to a time sharing, and help me, I want to make sure that I'm correctly understanding this. The first 5 minutes will go to, will be argued by the Attorney General, by Mr. Cox, is that right? And then after that, the remaining 10 minutes will be done by Ms. Cruz, but we should find out in advance what, if any, rebuttal time you want reserved so that our timekeeper can make the appropriate adjustments. And then Mr. Hurd will have the 15 minutes, up to 15 minutes for the appellee, and then the rebuttal back to Ms. Cruz. All right, with that having been said, we're ready on the Canales case. And Ms. Cruz, just let us know how much time you want reserved. We'll make a note now.
Chief Judge, would you like to reserve 4 minutes for
Chief Judge, and may it please the Court, I'm Trevor Cox from the Office of the Attorney General, which the Court invited to file an amicus brief in this case and participate in oral argument. After reviewing the issues in the case, we filed a brief in support of the appellant on two limited issues. Our first point is that in cases where JNDR and circuit courts have exercised their jurisdiction to make a custody determination, we submit that they also have power to, under the code, to make SIJ findings. We do not take a position on what those SIJ findings should, in fact, be in this case.
Mr. Cox?
Yes.
I take it that it is the Attorney General's position that nothing in the Immigration and Nationality Act, whether the specific subsection or any other part of it, creates an independent cause of action in Virginia courts. It's all ancillary to some function that the courts are already providing.
Yes, Your Honor. Unless the state court has jurisdiction over a custody matter or a dependency matter, there is no independent jurisdiction to make SIJ findings.
Is there a waiver of jurisdiction in this case because there were two action numbers assigned at the JNDR court level, and appellant has conceded that the SIJS part of the case was not appealed?
We do not take a position on that matter, Your Honor. I'm sure that Ms. Booth would be more than prepared to address that question. Our point is merely that when a court has jurisdiction over a custody matter, making SIJ findings falls within the express and broad inherent authority.
Mr. Cox, let me interrupt you if I can. Let's talk about what the specific SIJ, we refer to SIJ findings of fact. Let's talk about what they are. The federal statute speaks to the state courts applying state law with respect to certain factors, abandonment, abuse, etc. Would you agree that in that context, then, the plain language of the statute is the state court, in this case the circuit court, because the matter was up on appeal from juvenile court, doesn't consider anything outside of the Code of Virginia with respect to subsection 1 of that definitional statute in the Code of the United States Code?
Well, I believe the statutory language, 8 U.S.C. 1101 and the regulations provide that abuse, neglect, or abandonment or similar state under state law.
So in other words, basically you get a judgment from a state court, juvenile court, or a circuit court after an appeal, and that judgment reflects action applying, in our case, the Code of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And if that happens to satisfy one of these statutory factors that the federal statute lays out, you can march down to Department of Homeland Security, INS, or whoever, and present that judgment. Is that correct?
That's right. A petitioner would take the state court predicate order and present it to USCIS.
So it's not up to the, if I understand you correctly, you're not saying that the state court must tailor its findings to assist someone in achieving SIJ status. It's simply apply state law, and if that happens to help you, great. If it doesn't, that's the way it goes.
I guess what I'd say is state courts, juvenile courts have broad discretion, inherent authority, and also express authority under the code to consider factors that are set forth in the code that are very similar to the SIJ findings that are requested.
But the term state law, it seems to me, that's used by Congress has to have some meaning. It doesn't say apply federal law. It's apply state law, and if state law satisfies the definition of abandonment or abuse, physical or sexual, et cetera, then you've got something to work with. If not, you don't have anything to work with. Isn't that where kind of the statutory scheme?
I guess I'd respond by saying that because the juvenile courts have such broad discretion under the code to make findings, there are certain considerations that they shall make, and they overlap so consistently with the SIJ findings. The catch-all consideration that they can make in Code 124.310 says they shall consider anything that's necessary and proper. They have discretion to make those findings, and that would be under
state. Well, I guess my question comes down to simply, and this will be my last question. I don't want to beat this dead horse too much, but I guess my question simply comes down to what's the Attorney General's interpretation of this statutory scheme? Is it that state courts look at the federal criteria of abandonment, abuse, et cetera, and make specific findings as to those factors, or do they apply state law as the statute suggests? And if it happens to, if applying state law happens to satisfy those factors, but it's not up to the state court to determine that, it's up to the Department of Homeland Security to determine that.
I think it's clear that state law is the touchstone, and the findings that they're making are under state law. Federal immigration decisions are made by federal officials, and so the predicate order is taken to USCIS, and they're the ones that are making immigration decisions. And as we've argued in our brief, it's entirely possible for a juvenile court to make these findings without encroaching on federal immigration officials.
Counsel, it's clear that the state court does not have express authority to make these findings, and you have made the reference to the term inherent, inherent authority. Could a state court, a juvenile court, in exercise of its inherent authority, make a decision that it is not going to make those determinations?
I don't think that a court that has jurisdiction can just say, no, I'm choosing not to exercise it.
Mr. Cox, in your brief, you've made very clear, you carefully chose the words that it triggers the court's authority, but it doesn't trigger a requirement that the order contain any particular language. There are parts of the Code of Virginia that require, and the order shall so state, and list the various things. That's not applicable here. If the order simply said, and sole legal custody is granted to the mother in any type of custody case, that order is not deficient on its face, is it?
I would say it's deficient, but it's not necessarily what the petitioner asks for. If the petitioner asks for something, as in any court, the court has an obligation to exercise that jurisdiction and say either yes or no.
Are you familiar with the courts deciding things on the best and narrowest grounds? Because we decline to answer questions that we're empowered to answer all the time.
I'm sure that's true in this court. Juvenile and domestic relations courts are empowered to decide a whole host of things, and are given flexibility to craft relief that are particular to the circumstances of those cases.
But if the court decides to make a decision, it makes a decision just on custody, and the court, as the circuit court in this case, said we don't have jurisdiction to make the SIJ finding, but they make a decision on custody, why couldn't they, if X, Y, and Z are required for SIJ findings, make a decision on custody, and if they decide X, Y, and Z, that could still be used by the federal government, Department of Homeland Security, to make the final decision that it has to make, correct? As long as that those various criteria are decided in the custody decree.
Yes, sir. Sometimes custody orders are themselves used as SIJ petition material. They don't have to be separate SIJ orders. Our point is that the state court should make decisions under state law responding to the requests that are made by appellant, but they are themselves not making federal immigration decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Ms. Cruz?
May it please the court.
Ms. Cruz, let me just jump in and start you off with a procedural issue that's, you know, that we have to get around before we can address anything else. This case generated two judgments, two orders, only one of which was appealed, and I think on your brief you conceded that point. The one that was not appealed is the one that it seems to me is squarely congruent with your assignment of error that the trial court erred in not making specific SIJ findings of fact. That was not appealed. So given that, I mean, where do you see us procedurally? How do we address the remaining order given that the other order was not appealed?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the trial court's broad discretionary power was triggered by the mother's petition for custody under 16.1-241. And we appealed case number 127 because that is the case number assigned to the petition for custody, which triggered the trial court's authority to consider and issue the SIJ findings of fact. Case number 128 is the result of a local idiosyncratic practice that assigns separate case numbers to a petition for custody and then the ancillary requests for the SIJ findings of fact. The code does not authorize, and we do not contend that the code authorizes a standalone petition for SIJ findings of fact. What we argue and what we're asking this court to find is that once independent subject matter jurisdiction is established, as it was here via the petition for custody, then the trial court has the authority and jurisdiction to enter the SIJ findings of fact. The trial counsel asked for the court
to... Can I interrupt you, though, and ask you, if the custody decree is the only one that's appealed, then the order for the other one making the SIJ findings would not be before us, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Let me follow up on Judge Beal's question. The law is pretty clear that you can raise subject matter jurisdiction any place, any time, even for the first time on appeal. And I understand that that may be what you're doing with respect to the custody order. And I guess the question really devolves down to simply, what is the legal effect regarding our analysis of the fact that you failed to appeal the other judgment, which specifically relates to the issue you're now raising?
Well, Your Honor, the trial counsel invited the court to issue the findings either as a part of the custody order or as a separate order, irrespective of the case numbers, and we can see that in the appendix, page 54. We also note from the record that it's clear the trial court believed it didn't have jurisdiction under either case number to enter these findings. And you can find that in the appendix, page 67, the court states, I have filled these orders based on my findings of fact. I don't know if they'll be sufficient for what you need, but I've done what I can.
Well, without the underlying predicate order of custody, the separate SIJS petition, if we were to look at it that way, would be a nullity anyway, wouldn't it?
Correct, Your Honor. There's no jurisdiction under the code that would authorize a standalone, separate petition for SIJ findings.
And
it has to be made via the petition for custody.
And the petition for custody in this case was seeking both.
Correct, Your Honor. And it's clear that the court noted that and treated the orders as one.
Well, and in fact, the custody order itself was submitted by the party requesting specific findings, and the court either gave you those findings or didn't give you those findings. It's quite clear that the court in the custody order addressed these issues.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, assuming that we get over the hurdle of the ability for the state court or the lower court to make the SIJ findings that you request, how do you deal with the fact that there is some suggestion, and I acknowledge that this making it a termination of parental rights case is sort of a non sequitur, but how do you deal with the fact that the trial court seemed to suggest that one of the predicates for establishing SIJ determinations was not met, i.e. that the abandonment was not proven?
Your Honor, I don't think we can speculate about what the trial court would have done absent its own self-imposed jurisdictional limitations. And on top of that, the improper application of an elevated burden of proof.
Do we have to speculate? I mean, doesn't...
Well, we believe that...
Doesn't the court specifically say, I'm not convinced by the second and, I believe, characterizing it as second and third party hearsay? You were the party with the burden, are you not?
We are the party with the burden, and we believe that based on the facts that were presented to the trial court, that abandonment was established.
If the trial court accepts them, but as fact finder, the trial court is free to reject them. Even if I were to look at the same testimony and say, you've proven abandonment, if the trial court says, I'm not convinced, doesn't the standard review dictate that you can't win on that issue?
Yes. However, we would like to note that the evidence presented, both through testimony and through the guardian ad litem's report, which is on page 40 of the appendix, it appears that Marvin has been abandoned by his father. There was testimony and evidence presented.
So you essentially have to argue that the trial court, the circuit court, was plainly wrong, and that there's no evidence to support its factual findings on abandonment or the other two issues you raise in your second assignment of error. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think before we get there also, it's clear that the court felt limited or restrained by what they were being asked to do.
But that's in the order that's not appealed. The statement that I can't do this is in the other order.
Well, the SIJ findings were stricken from the custody order, and if we turn to the record, we can see what the judge intended when she struck those findings from the order.
Might it be better to argue, counsel, that the determination regarding abandonment, assuming that that is what the trial court made, was made in the context of a termination or parental rights context as opposed to an SIJ context?
Yes, Your Honor. There was an elevated burden of proof applied to the evidence because the court did believe that they were terminating parental rights, which they were not. Through this action, the father is not precluded from being able to seek a modification of the custody order or petition the court for visitation.
You're deep in your rebuttal time.
Yeah. So, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hurd?
May it please the court. Let me begin by acknowledging that we have a problem in Virginia when children come here to rejoin one parent and make allegations of wrongdoing against the other parent. But we also have a problem when we think about that other parent, the one down still in Latin America, the one who did not break our laws by coming here without a visa, the one who often does not know where his child is, the one who does not read public notices in the Washington Times, who does not know his rights are being adjudicated, and who, if he did know, could not lawfully come here to defend himself. That other parent is my client, Marvin Alejandro Torres Orihana. He has no idea who I am. He has no idea that we are here. If we cannot give him actual notice of proceedings that involve him, if we cannot give him an actual opportunity to present the facts.
Well, publication notice, though, is an accepted means of providing notice under these proceedings, isn't it?
I understand, Judge Chubb. It is not actual notice. All I'm asking is that we assure him that we will scrupulously follow the law in Virginia and not take the shortcuts that some on the other side...
Mr. Hurd, let me follow up on Judge Huff's point, because let's all hope that we're going to follow the law of Virginia here. You might at least grant us the presumption that we might actually do that in this case.
So
to follow up on Judge Huff's point, service by publication is permitted, and it was done here. Now, I think where you're going with all this, I suspect, is that clearly, reading between the lines, the trial court had difficulty, notwithstanding the fact that the service by publication was technically obtained here, with the fact, I mean, there were some concerns that were clearly expressed by the circuit court here that may have impacted, I think Ms. Cruz's argue is, has impacted on the court's decision-making here in not making the actual finding of abandonment, given the lack of actual notes. So, but what we are here, and there's really, I don't hear you really arguing that we don't actually have personal jurisdiction over your client.
Not in this case.
Okay.
In the other case, not in this
case. Well, we're not there yet.
Right.
So.
Not in this case. Well, with respect to an elevated burden of proof, the court below never said that. It was applying an elevated burden of proof. And the assignments of error do not contain any suggestion there was an elevated burden of proof. So that's not an issue in the case. There are at least three procedural problems that prevent the court, in our view, in this case, from treating this case as a test case to reach the larger issues that have been presented. The first problem is that the order in 128 was not appealed.
Let me start with that one. Would you agree or disagree that an SIJ petition provides an independent basis for being in the juvenile court and then the circuit court? Does it provide an independent basis?
Disagree with that.
Okay. Do you take the view that a custody petition provides an independent basis for anybody to be in juvenile court with regard to the best interest of a child? That's the easy one.
Well, custody, but there are limitations on what a court can do in the course of a custody proceeding.
Okay. Now, in the course of a custody proceeding, the juvenile court has broad authority to do what it believes is in the best interest of the child.
Our view would be, cutting to the larger issues,
yes, sir.
We're fighting for a moment over the procedural rules. Our view would be that if in the course of deciding custody, a court finds it necessary to make findings that parallel SAJ findings, then the court can, of course, do that. If the court, in the course of making a custody decision, finds it helpful to make findings that parallel those of SAJ findings, the court can do that.
So why wouldn't it be appropriate from a tactical standpoint for a litigant who is petitioning for SIJ determination to say the best course of action to invoke the jurisdiction of this court would be to pursue this through a traditional custody case as opposed to an SIJ petition that the court probably does not have independent jurisdiction over?
Well, that they may well do that, but the third point I was going to make is that if a court can make a custody decision, particularly a custody decision in favor of the petitioner, without making SIJ findings, then we see no obligation on the part of the court to step outside its role under the statute and make such findings, particularly where they would be purely advisory in nature. But let me return, if I may, to the procedural rules. First one is, didn't appeal, number 128. That does two things. One, it means that for this case, the lack of subject matter jurisdiction to make SIJ findings is res judicata. Secondly, leaving aside the jurisdictional point, in case 128, the circuit court decided there was no abandonment. That is res judicata. And without abandonment, then how does this court reach the larger issues?
Counsel, is that a factual finding or a legal finding?
It was a factual
abandonment.
A factual finding.
And that's viewed how on appeal?
Well, this was not appealed. 128 was not appealed.
Then she's asking what the standard of
review is. I'm just asking what the standard for abandonment.
Well, if it was, you had to have an abuse of discretion by the court in its view of the facts. Which brings me to the third procedural.
Can I ask you, though, on your first one, on your second one, rather, that the abandonment was not in the custody decree? It is, essentially, isn't it?
Point. It is addressed in the custody decree. So even if you forgot about 128 completely, and you look at the custody decree, the court was presented with a sketch of an order by opposing counsel that tried to shoehorn abandonment into two or three different parts of the statute, paragraph 3, paragraph 7, paragraph 9.
But if the court is saying, I don't have jurisdiction, but if I did, maybe I would make these decisions. At some point, doesn't it become dicta?
Sure. You know, that is not what the court said. The order on page 42 of the appendix, the order in the custody case, the court obviously could find abandonment as part of finding custody. Right? Of course it could. The court did not. The court struck through the words, abandonment of the minor child. Quote, the father has not been informed of the whereabouts of the minor child. That is a very focused judicial decision.
It is, Mr. Hurd, but it raises this. While nominally they didn't challenge the ability or... In 128 is the case that talks expressly about SAJ findings. This order and what you've just said, the issue... The pertinent issues were raised in the custody order itself, so why isn't that properly before the circuit court, and therefore, because they appealed it, why is it not properly in front of us, absent, I guess, a claim preclusion theory?
There is a claim preclusion theory here.
But absent a claim preclusion theory, if they, to use your hypothetical, assuming 128 never existed, all of this would be properly before us simply because they asked for it in the order and the judge made a rule and she scratched it out.
If 128 did not exist, of course it does, but if 128 did not exist, and the case before this court purely on 127, then opposing counsel would have had to have argued that there was an abuse of discretion by the trial court in its handling of the facts. There was no such assignment of error made.
The counsel, you would agree that there is a problem with maybe the way that the trial court approached this and that they approached it as a termination of parental rights case. I think we can all agree that this isn't a termination case.
I think what the court said is that essentially there is termination of parental rights when you have a teenage boy nearing his age majority. He's in this country. His father cannot legally enter this country. And the question is, what is the court going to assist in ensuring that the child and the father are not reunited? Well, the father has no meaningful way of challenging that. I mean, the court, you know.
So, but we all agree that this is not a termination.
It is not a termination.
And would you also agree that the standard of proof in a termination case may well be different than the standard of proof in a case like this?
Yes, it is. But the court did not say it was applying a clear and convincing evidence standard to this case, nor has the burden of proof applied by the circuit court been made a part of any assignment of error in this case. So what we're stuck with here is, if you look at page, say, 43 in the appendix, another part of the custody order, where the court focused very clearly on this phrase, the minor's father has abandoned him under Virginia law. Not SIJ law, Virginia law. The minor's father has abandoned him under Virginia law due to his renunciation or abdication of responsibility over the child or a voluntary relinquishment of the child without cause, citing a Virginia case, Todd v. Copeland. Court focused on this proposed finding put to him by opposing counsel and struck through it, declining to make the finding under Virginia law that would show abandonment. So there has been no abandonment of this child by my client.
Can I follow up on your point in that on the abandonment and then the other two issues raised in appellant's second assignment of error? I thought I heard you just say that you thought that assignment of error did not include an argument or support an argument that deals with the standard of review of making those factual findings of an abuse of discretion standard of review. But in saying the circuit court erred in declining to rule that, and it lists the three things that it disagrees with, wouldn't that encompass that same sort of abuse of discretion or sufficiency standard of review?
Judge Beals, if somewhere in the brief those words had been used, then I might be more inclined to agree with you, but I don't see any abuse of discretion argument in the brief. What I see is a view that the court has the jurisdiction to make SIJ findings.
Mr. Hurd, have we ever stated that it is an automatic automatically dismiss an appeal because the litigant fails to state the appropriate assignment of error? I mean, there's a requirement in the assignment of error to state the proper standard of review. We require the standard of review to be stated, but people misstate them all the time, and we still reach the merits of the argument.
My point is not that they fail to cite the appropriate standard of review. My point is they nowhere argue the standard of review, either in their brief or in the assignment of error in particular. Their brief simply asked the court to put blinders on and to disregard the finding of no abandonment. The court, they want you to disregard. That is what the circuit court found.
Well, right, but that's
directly to the issue.
But that's a merits determination for us to make. And I was hearing you saying that we're somehow procedurally barred from reaching that question.
I believe you are, Your Honor, because if you accept that there is no abandonment in this case, which is the unchallenged finding of the circuit court, in 127, not to mention the res judicata finding in 128, that there is no abandonment.
From the standpoint of the merits, Mr. Hurd, let me ask you, the Attorney General argues that applying state law by a state court. And we certainly, I probably can all agree, we don't want individual judges making their own immigration policy. Having said that, though, do you agree with the Attorney General's position that, assuming we ever get to the merits of this case, that the application would be simply be that you take a petition, apply state law to it, the state court applies state law to it. If that happens to help, you advance a immigration position you want to take in another forum, all well and good. Otherwise, you know, that's just the end of it. It's the way the chips fall.
Judge Humphreys, I do agree with that completely. The way this federal statute is written, it does not purport to impose any obligation on a state court to apply any federal standards at all.
Well, in fact, in this case, but for the procedural bars, you would agree, wouldn't you, that there is jurisdiction using the this first assignment of error language, there is jurisdiction for a trial court, JNDR court, circuit court, to make SIJS findings as long as it's attached to some underlying Virginia action.
If they are useful or necessary in order to make the custody decision, yes. If they are appendages to that decision, to serve merely an advisory role vis-a-vis the federal immigration authorities, then no. That would be an advisory opinion.
Because there's no state statute that specifically
authorizes
that.
Well, doesn't
the fact
statute. Some states, like Maryland, they passed a statute that tells their courts to make these decisions anyway, and perhaps Virginia should.
Doesn't the fact that these SIJS findings could affect immigration make it something other than advisory?
No. Of course, those are the authorities to whom you are advising. It is unlike all the other orders that are part of the court's inherent authority that opposing counsel's briefs talk about, where the court is ordering something be done, or the court is ordering something not be done. And the courts have wide discretion to give orders of what can be done or not be done, but not to give advisory opinions, as they seek, actually, in this case, asking you to jump to the merits of an issue when there are procedural rules.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kerr. Ms. Cruz, your remaining time.
Your Honors, no party here has sought to defend the erroneous position that JNDR courts and circuit courts lack jurisdiction and authority to enter these SIJ findings of fact and to consider them when appropriate. And narrowing the scope of what a trial court may consider with respect to a child's best interest is a slippery slope and should give this should cause the court caution.
There are provisions in Virginia law that requires trial courts in their orders to make specific findings. To the best of my reading regarding a garden variety custody case, there isn't such a requirement. If there is no such a requirement and a statement that sole legal custody is awarded to the mothers for the reasons stated from the bench, if that's sufficient for Virginia law purposes, how can it ever be error for the court not to make findings?
Well, Your Honor, form matters, and it's not uncommon for there to be a need for specific language to be used in an order. Qualified domestic relations orders are an example of the federal government requiring specific language in a state court order. Moreover, the code doesn't put a limitation on the language that a trial court can use.
About in an unopposed custody petition?
There's no limitation that the code provides.
But why is the court required to make those findings?
The court isn't required to make the findings, but the court is required to consider them. And it's required to consider them because of the statutory best interest factors. And what SIJ findings of fact are asking the court to engage in is in its usual assessment of what is in the best interest of the child. These findings mirror the best interest factors.
But is there any requirement that the trial court then list out in written form its evaluation of each of those factors individually? I mean, it seems to me that's your problem. You're saying that the trial court needed to put these things in its order, but if Virginia law doesn't require the trial court to put these things in its order, how can that be error?
Because what they need to do is put into words what will protect the best interest of the child. And under 16.1-278.15, it states that courts, trial courts, can make any order of disposition necessary to protect the welfare of the child. The child needs these findings stated in a specific manner in order to petition the court for SIJ findings of,
and
for the SIJ status.
I think you've made the point that Judge Russell is trying to make. You read the statute, says the juvenile court can, doesn't say it must.
Correct. And then we could be potentially talking about a different case. The reason why we're appealing this case the way that we are is because the circuit court found that it didn't have jurisdiction. My hands are tied. I would consider these things, but I can't. And what we're asking the court to do is to empower them and to know that they have the authority and jurisdiction to consider it.
Counsel, we understand the difficulty that you face with the case, but the, but we're trying to hone in on what can and can't be done here. Are these the findings that were crossed out by the judge? Those are factual findings, aren't they?
Correct.
And if you could answer, respond to that and then wrap it up.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. Those are factual findings. And it's important to keep in mind that deciding that courts lack subject matter jurisdiction to make these findings would also not only have a slippery slope effect on a broader impact, it would also disrupt the thousands of existing SIJ orders, which the VBA's Commission on the Needs of Children estimate would unsettle the interests of about 1,382 children per year who have relied on those findings. So we would request that this court remand this case back to the circuit court with instruction that it has authority and jurisdiction to consider and issue these findings.
Thank you, Ms. Cruz. The Canales case is submitted. You'll be hearing from us shortly. Thank you very much to all counsel. Now the